step for Biden, to be so clear. I know his campaign's walking back some aspects of it, but the larger piece to speak so clearly on the stage about oil. And then you have Donald Trump on the other end at every turn, not actually like issuing a belief about anything, but speaking specifically to states, talking about the strategy. It's sort of what he does. I do think that we are seeing the results of a lot of work and effort and activism of pushing the Democratic Party, of raising the stakes on what we are facing in terms of climate and in terms of what has been allowed by major corporations to be able to pollute our environment, and particularly to be able to put so much pollution right at the back door of Black and brown communities.
And Eric Andiola, you tweeted last night that you grew up near an ExxonMobil plant. You know what frontline communities are about. 10 seconds.
We do. And I, again, as the pandemic right now shows, every time there's something happening in the environment, something that is happening outside of our control, people of color, communities of color, Black communities, Native American communities, undocumented people are the ones who suffer the most. And so we need to make sure that, yes, climate change is at the top of the agenda of the next president. And, you know, we don't know what Biden is going to do, but at this point, we know what Trump has not done.
We have to leave it there. Eric Andiola and Rashad Robinson, thanks so much. I'm Amy Goodman. Special thanks to Julie Crosby.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be ours.
Oh, this is KBOO Portland.
Attention all KBOO members. Ballots for our board of directors election have been mailed out, so check your mailbox. Then make sure to tune in on Tuesday, October 27th at 10 a.m. or Wednesday, October 28th at 7 p.m. to hear interviews with your candidates for KBOO's board of directors. We'll be asking each of our candidates about their skills and experience to help you decide who to vote for. Again, that's October 27th at 10 a.m. or Wednesday, October 28th at 7 p.m. right here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of L'Arche Portland Benefit Celebration on Saturday, October 24th from 6 to 7 p.m. streaming online. This benefit will highlight the gift of individuals with and without intellectual disabilities. There will be musical performances, an auction, and testimonials covering the mission and impact of L'Arche. Again, that's L'Arche Portland Benefit Celebration, Saturday, October 24th from 6 to 7 p.m. streaming online. You can find more information at kboo.fm on the right side of our homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, activist group Don't Shoot Portland is seeking sanctions against the Portland Police Bureau for violating a June restraining order limiting the use of so-called less lethal weapons. The vacant Greyhound station in downtown Portland will be used as a temporary shelter for houseless folks beginning in November, and the country hit its highest number of new daily COVID-19 cases yesterday. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 23rd, 2020. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Nat Moon. Activist group Don't Shoot Portland is seeking sanctions against the Portland Police Bureau for violating a June restraining order limiting the use of so-called less lethal weapons. U.S. District Judge Marco Hernandez listened to 2 days of testimony from protesters and police officers over police actions on the night of June 30th outside the Portland Police Association building in North Portland. According to attorneys for the protesters, the night in question was, quote, a snapshot, one example of many over the past 5 months in which Portland police used unnecessary violence on nonviolent protesters. On June 26th, Judge Hernandez restricted the launching of so-called less lethal weapons into largely peaceful crowds. His restraining order also limited the use of rubber bullets and pepper spray to life-threatening situations. The aim of the restraining order was to protect those peacefully protesting from injury and attack by indiscriminate weapons. Attorneys for Don't Shoot Portland provided video evidence of police firing rubber bullets, smoke grenades, and tear gas, as well as bull rushing the crowd and beating individuals with batons. There was evidence that police acted against individuals before any assault happened. Brent Taylor, an officer notorious for excessive violence at protests, testified that he shot 40 to 60 rounds of weapons from his FN 303 launcher that night. He admitted to shooting the weapons so much because he feared protesters would throw back the very weapons being used against them, specifically tear gas canisters. Brent Taylor said, quote, "They're heavy, they're extremely hot, they're a great danger." Air Force veteran Eric Greatwood was live streaming that night with his phone atop his characteristic 20-foot painter's pole. He said he leaned down to examine a canister on the ground when he was shot directly in the groin. The officer who shot him was Brent Taylor. Shooting the groin is against police policy. Multiple witnesses described being in the wrong place at the wrong time when attacked. One person was holding a sign, another was standing in the street. One kicked a canister out of the street away from his wife, who was coughing and choking on tear gas at the time. Police trainer Zachary Domka admitted in court that Portland police haven't received training on the use of so-called less lethal weapons since last November. Judge Hernandez has said he will view video and other documentation of use of force before making his decision. It is unknown how long this decision will take. According to the Oregonian, if the Bureau is found in contempt of court, a separate hearing will determine what further actions and possible sanctions are necessary. The vacant downtown Portland Greyhound station is finding new life as a temporary shelter for houseless folks. The site will have 100 beds and be open 24 hours a day until the end of March, with tentative opening plans slated for mid-November. For those experiencing homelessness, priority will be given to those over the age of 55 and to people with disabilities or those who are military veterans. The bus terminal was in service for over 30 years before Greyhound put the property on sale last year. Portland and Multnomah County, through the Joint Office of Homeless Services, will be paying $30,000 per month for the site's main floor and outdoor loading area during its use as a shelter. The terminal lies within 34 acres in northwest Portland, designated to be redeveloped into a new residential neighborhood as part of the Broadway Corridor project, with hopes of providing more than 500 individual residences. Two other Portland locations are also being used as temporary shelters through winter, with 75 beds available at the Mount Scott Community Center, scheduled for opening in mid-November, and 100 beds available at North Portland's Charles Jordan Community Center, which is open now. Other areas being used as shelters during the coronavirus pandemic include space at the Oregon Convention Center, three outdoor sites, and four motels that have been turned into shelters run by nonprofit organizations in the area. Disaster food benefits are available for Oregonians impacted by the recent fires. Here's Eric Tegedoff with more on the story.
Disaster food benefits are available for Oregonians in eight counties affected by September's massive wildfires. Dan Hahn is director of self-sufficiency programs at the Oregon Department of Human Services. He says the Disaster Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or DSNAP, is meant to reach people in need who typically aren't eligible for food assistance.
It's just an opportunity to take some of that anxiety that exists with all of the losses that individuals and families have had and allow them to have a little something extra to bridge that gap as they get back to normal.
Disaster SNAP will provide a month of benefits. Hahn says the plan is to take applications based on people's last names, starting with A through E today. The last day to apply is Wednesday. The eight eligible counties are Clackamas, Douglas, Jackson, Klamath, Lane, Lincoln, Lynn, and Marion. Matt Newell-Ching, the public policy manager for Oregon Food Bank, says disaster SNAP will be a crucial lifeline for families who've been affected by the fires.
It's not only good for families who receive the benefits, but it's also good for our communities because those food benefits are spent in local grocery stores and sustain jobs in our communities, which are also impacted right now. And so it's a win-win for our communities.
He also notes for Oregonians who are immigrants, the program does not impact the so-called public charge test. Newell-Ching says Oregon Food Bank has been helping get food to people in need.
We have seen in some areas new points of food distribution developed. We also know that that's not enough, and that's why responses like Disaster SNAP are so critical for our communities.
People curious about their DSNAP eligibility can call 211 or apply at disasterfoodassistance.org. Folks can also find local pantries at OregonFoodFinder.org. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Oregon Health Authority announced on Thursday that counties still in phase one of COVID reopening will be allowed to open bowling alleys and skating rinks with some restrictions. In a five-page order, the OHA laid out a number of rules and guidelines for the recreational venues to abide by as coronavirus cases statewide are still rising. Counties still in phase one include the metro area counties of Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington, and Malheur County in southeast Oregon. Thursday's ruling comes following a spike in COVID cases at the beginning of October, which has since leveled off in the last week. The order allows up to 50 people to gather, either indoors or outdoors, with individual bowling alleys and roller rinks maintaining varied limits based on their specific size and space. Maximum occupancy is determined by individual parties being able to remain distanced at least 6 feet from other parties, with further restrictions on the number of other individuals on the premises. Groups up to 10 may qualify as a single party. Staff and customers will be required to wear face coverings at all times, and the order requires businesses to limit bowling and skating times to scheduled appointments, with breaks in between to clean and sanitize previously used areas. Staff has been instructed to collect customer information to help health authorities with contact tracing in case a positive coronavirus case is identified. With winter months nearly upon us, public health officials are concerned about further spikes in COVID infections, as Oregonians will likely be spending more time indoors. Despite these concerns, there is also a cautious urgency to resume other public activities, notably the resumption of in-person school. Yesterday, the U.S. recorded its highest number of new daily cases, with 77,640 new cases of the virus. The previous daily record of 75,723 was set in July. Some news agencies list the total new cases closer to 73,000, which would make yesterday the second highest daily total ever. Either way, the increase in cases reveals an upward trend that experts say cannot be explained by increased testing. Similarly, worldwide, the WHO reported the largest single increase in cases from yesterday to today. The amount of cases reported worldwide today has reached the alarming number of 445,000. 6,500 deaths were also reported worldwide today. In a briefing on Wednesday, Deputy Director of Infectious Disease at the CDC, Dr. Jay Butler, warned of a, quote, distressing trend as 75% of the country is seeing an increase in cases. The Washington Post also reported hospitalizations due to the virus are up in 38 states this week. 14 states have reported record high levels of hospitalizations, with many rural hospitals near or at capacity. As the virus spreads throughout the Midwest and Rocky Mountains, health officials warn of an especially difficult winter. With people retreating indoors as the weather cools and flu season hits, experts worry Americans will see another huge surge in cases. At last night's debate, President Trump assured viewers that the pandemic, quote, will soon be gone. There have been a total of 8.5 million cases in the United States and over 223,000 deaths. Worldwide, 42 million people have been infected, with over a million dead. Experts encourage everyone to continue wearing masks, washing their hands, and social distancing. listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO's News in Depth. We take a deep dive with Portland mayoral candidate Sarah Iannarone and hear from a journalist in Chile about the upcoming constitutional referendum this Sunday. Stay tuned for Let's Talk About Race at 6, then at 7, it's Rising Up with Sana Lee. Tonight's weather will be mostly cloudy with a low of 47, and tomorrow, expect scattered showers with a high of 51. Today in history, in 1944, 13-year-old Hannah Brady was murdered at Auschwitz. She is the subject of a children's book called Hannah's Suitcase, written to convey the story of the Holocaust to other kids. She, along with millions of other people, was killed by the SS, a militia group that began as a volunteer unit and grew to be one of the most powerful organizations in Europe during the Adolf Hitler administration. Today, administrations around the world continue to use such militia groups to further their political agendas. Many political experts, in fact, drew parallels between the SS and Proud Boys when Trump told the latter, "Stand back and stand by," at a debate earlier this year. The quote of the day is from writing duo Mai Showal and Per Walu, who wrote, quote, "The very idea of a militia comprises a far greater danger to society than any criminal or gang." Canada's senior police officer is defending the Royal Canadian Mounted Police's response to violent confrontations between Indigenous and non-Indigenous fishers. With that story and more, it's Megan Kamrick with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick, in for Antonia Gonzalez. As violent confrontations continue between Indigenous and non-Indigenous lobster fishermen in Nova Scotia, Canada's senior police officer is defending the Royal Canadian Mounted Police response. Dan Karpinchuk has more.
RCMP Commissioner Brenda Luckey says the RCMP is fully committed to keeping the peace, keeping people safe, and enforcing the law. She also confirmed that additional officers have been dispatched to Nova Scotia. There have been violent confrontations, property destroyed, vandalism, and a lobster plant burned to the ground. That after Indigenous fishermen took to the water out of season, claiming it was their treaty right to fish whenever and wherever they want, a right that was upheld by Canada's highest court 20 years ago, that First Nations had a right to fish to earn a moderate livelihood. But non-Indigenous fishermen want Ottawa to stop the Indigenous harvesting, saying that court ruling also said the government could continue to regulate the fishery. An emergency session in the Canadian Parliament earlier this week failed to find a solution to the issue of just what is a moderate livelihood. The chief of the Sabinakati First Nation, Mike Sachs, says the dispute has cost his band more than $1.5 million and his fishermen are being shut out of the market.
Nobody would deal with us. Like, we reached out to so many trying to move lobster, and anyone could buy them with a buyer's license, and nobody will take them. So we have at least like a $1.5 million hit to our community. We can't sell our lobster. Everyone in the area has been told that they will not take our, if they take our lobster, they'll boycott or they'll be blacklisted.
Sachs says it will take time to rebuild relationships in the industry with people and companies who are now afraid of retaliation if they deal with the Indigenous fishermen. Sachs says he wants those responsible to be held accountable. He's also filed an application for a court injunction aimed at any harassment of Indigenous fishermen where the fleet is based. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A Native American tribe in Oregon has become the first in the U.S. to receive full authority to manage its forests. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs approved the Coquille Tribe's Indian Trust Asset Management Plan Tuesday. This grants it autonomy over its 10,000 acres of trust forest land and resources, a first for any of the country's 574 federally recognized tribes. Mark Johnston is executive director for the Coquille Indian Tribe.
We're just really excited about the opportunity to be first. We respect the burden that creates going first, because you better do it right or you'll mess it up for those folks that come behind you. And we know we're not going to be the only tribe that considers this because of the value from a sovereignty perspective.
Sovereignty, or self-governance, is a long-standing goal for tribes, and timber is an important resource for the Coquille. Johnston says annual revenues support key programs, including tribal health care and education.
For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
A federal judge ruled Thursday that he will not force the Pima County Recorder to establish an early voting site in a Southern Arizona tribe's reservation next week. Emma Gibson with Arizona Public Media has more.
The Pascuayaki tribe sued Pima County Recorder F.N. Rodriguez in an effort to reinstate an early voting site her office closed in 2018. Jonathan Diaz is part of the tribe's legal team. He says, though this isn't the result they wanted, he knows tribal leaders will continue to advocate for voting opportunities in the reservation.
Members of the Pascuayaki tribe who testified, I think, really highlighted the burdens and the obstacles that tribal members face in accessing early voting without a site on or closer to the reservation.
During the hearing, the tribe argued that with lower car ownership, distrust of voting by mail, and higher rates of underlying conditions, an early in-person voting site in the reservation would benefit its residents. For National Native News, I'm Emma Gibson.
I'm Megan Kamrick.
Health experts say the darkest days of COVID lie ahead. Mike Moen with the Public News Service has more on the story.
Minnesota is seeing an acceleration of COVID-19 cases and deaths, and a leading local epidemiologist warns the region and the nation could be in for a rough winter. The state health department says Minnesota is averaging more than 1,000 cases each day this month. There is also concern about a recent spike in coronavirus fatalities. Michael Osterholm, who directs the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, says based on a variety of trends, the public should brace for more troubling reports.
I think we are about to enter the darkest days of the pandemic, not only here in Minnesota, but throughout the entire country. A combination of pandemic fatigue, pandemic anger, and then just the increased frequency of indoor air exposures.
He says families might still be planning holiday gatherings despite the risk of spreading the virus. Osterholm also notes some hospitals might not have enough specialized staff to treat patients in intensive care units, and he worries the production of PPE won't be enough to meet the rising demand. Hospitalizations for the virus also are trending upward in Minnesota. Osterholm says it isn't enough just to have adequate bed capacity. He says there's real concern about the staffing levels to produce better outcomes for critical patients.
The nursing staff that work in intensive care, the entire team, you know, from respiratory therapy across the board, all offer a very, very unique service to these patients that you can't find just in any other physician or nurse.
He says the nation could also see shortages of the medications used to treat COVID patients, as many are developed in other countries where the supply chain is being disrupted. Public health officials are also voicing concerns about COVID fatigue setting in, even among people who carefully followed the safety guidelines early in the pandemic. For those hoping to break from isolation during the holidays and meet with family, Osterholm warns it's almost impossible to avoid any risk, even if there's an attempt to quarantine before the gathering.
If you have some family members that do and some that don't, the chances of the virus entering into that household becomes a huge risk.
He says the state and nation won't see real improvement until a safe and effective vaccine is available. This week, the U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary said vaccines won't likely be available to the American public at large until April of next year. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
The second and final presidential debate was much more controlled than the first. With more on the story, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
The goal is for you to hear each other and for the American people to hear every word of what you both have to say.
The nation saw a much more controlled final debate yesterday. NBC News' Kristen Welker moderated far fewer interruptions from President Donald Trump in the Nashville debate with former Vice President Joe Biden. Policy differences came more into focus than in the past. Trump sounded many of his stock themes.
We're rounding the corner. It's going away. I'm the least racist person in this room. I'd like to terminate Obamacare, come up with a brand new, beautiful health care. I want to release it.
You've been saying for four years you're going to reduce your taxes.
Trump continued the personal attacks on Biden and his family, focusing on Biden's son, Hunter, following an unverified story in the New York Post about Hunter's business dealings. He repeatedly accused Biden of taking foreign money.
I have not taken a penny from any foreign source ever in my life.
Biden refrained from pointing out all the money Trump and his children have made overseas during his presidency, repeatedly saying it's about America's families, not the candidates. Trump did say he hasn't taken money from Russia, denying what's been his cozy relationship with Vladimir Putin.
Between the sanctions, nobody tougher than me on Russia.
This week, security agencies warned that Russia and Iran are interfering in the election. While Trump pivoted to attacks on Biden's family when asked about foreign interference, Biden was clear.
They will pay a price if I'm elected. They're interfering with American sovereignty.
Again, Trump falsely claimed Biden wants to shut down the economy. Biden declared, in fact, he also wants to open up and challenged Trump to help get the resources needed to do so safely.
Schools, they need a lot of money to open. They need to deal with ventilation systems. They need to deal with smaller classes, more teachers, more pods. And he's refused to support that money, or at least up to now.
Closing remarks showed a stark contrast in the candidate's vision of the future. Trump warned of a major economic depression if he lost. Biden expressed hope about the possibilities of a new administration and a clean energy future.
We're going to choose to move forward because we have enormous opportunities to make things better.
Nearly 50 million votes have already been cast. In St. Petersburg, Florida yesterday, law enforcement officials said they will station deputies at early voting sites after two armed men who claimed to be security guards hired by the Trump campaign were seen outside a polling place. In Washington, D.C., Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor sharply dissented with the conservative majority's ruling to allow Alabama to ban curbside voting for people with disabilities. And Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee advanced Trump's conservative Catholic Supreme Court nominee Judge Amy Coney Barrett to a full Senate vote, despite the absence of boycotting Democratic members who the panel's rules require to be present for official business. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
A recent study shows that the availability of paid leave is effective in reducing the spread of COVID-19. Mike Moen with the Public News Service has more on the story.
New research suggests that access to emergency paid leave could help limit the spread of the coronavirus. Supporters of a broader pay time off proposal say it's needed in states such as Iowa, where there is no such requirement. The study, led by Cornell University and the Swiss Economic Institute, says states with access to emergency paid leave during the crisis have seen 400 fewer COVID cases per day. Dawn Hucklebridge is with the Paid Leave for All campaign, which is demanding the U.S. Senate vote on a relief bill from the House that would extend and make bigger temporary protections. They're set to expire in December, and Hucklebridge says the time to act is now.
The United States is one of the only countries in the whole world that has no kind of national paid leave policy. That's been a crisis in the making for quite some time, but that meant that when the pandemic hit, over 33 million of us did not have access to a single guaranteed paid sick day.
There is no Iowa law requiring private employers to provide sick leave, paid or unpaid, although many of them do offer the benefit. Opponents of a paid leave policy, including some business groups, say it would create substantial costs for employers. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has indicated he isn't willing to allow for a vote on a new relief bill until after the election. Sue Dinsdale of the Iowa Citizen Action Network says having a broader national policy is crucial for the state, especially since the current federal protections exempt businesses with 500 or more employees. And she notes it's harder on women, who make up nearly half of the state's workforce.
I spoke with a mother the other day who was caring for her children and her father, and she used up the time that she could and ended up having to leave her job in order to care for both generations of her family.
And Dinsdale says more of those scenarios could play out during the crisis given Iowa's aging population. She and the group are calling out Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst for voting against certain leave proposals by releasing ads in the state. Ernst did not respond to a request for comment. One poll by Paid Leave for All Action and Global Strategy Group found 85% of respondents in battleground states said they supported paid leave during COVID-19 and beyond. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
You're are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Samantha Law and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Megan Kamrick, Mike Moen, and Eric Tegedoff. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Nat Moon. Coming up next is KBOO News in Depth. We'll take a deep dive with Portland mayoral candidate Sarah Iannarone and hear from a journalist in Chile about the upcoming constitutional referendum on Sunday. Stay with us.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
In a year of pivotal elections, including the race for Portland mayor, KBOO sat down with mayoral candidate Sarah Iannarone to discuss her vision for the city. Sarah, you've talked about changing the dynamic between mayor and city council. You've said, for example, you'd like to collaborate horizontally with your colleagues. Talk about what that means and why you believe that's so important.
One of the questions we always get asked on the campaign trail is, what's your leadership style and how will you go? And you hear Mayor Wheeler say again and again, I'm collaborative. But then when you read the news, he picks fights with his colleagues at every level of government all the time, whether it was Kate Brown over COVID or Speaker Kotek over tear gas or Commissioner Hardesty around the police reform or Chair Kefouri around the Joint Office of Homelessness. That's not collaboration in action. And we may have a high level of turnover for the next city council, depending on who wins the UDaily Maps race. So I really want to go in with my strong mom vibes, my